Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean. You know, guns are extremely important in our society today. You hear about somebody getting shot every time you turn around. More importantly, it's a part of the Constitution that people will be allowed to carry guns or wear guns or own guns. Of course, we now are dealing with a situation where you have to have a permit, which is a blockage from being able to use one or own one. But that's it doesn't seem like it conflicts with the Constitution, but it's a part of the Constitution. In the Civil War, firearms, the guns of the North, that's what we're going to be dealing with today, a documentary on guns. So let's begin.
An intense new multiplayer mobile real-time strategy game. Welcome to the year 1861. The game is free to download and play. And right now, you can click on the link in the description to fight the Civil War on your very own smartphone. When the guns fired on Fort Sumter in April 1861, the federal government had about 500,000 shoulder arms held in arsenals in northern states. About 80% of these were 69 caliber smooth bores. The southern states possessed only about a third as many long guns, many seized from federal arsenals, and again, most were smooth bore muskets. These included old model 1816 and 1822 Springfield flintlock muskets, some of which had been converted to the percussion system and some not, as well as model 1842 muskets, which were manufactured as percussion guns from the start. Both sides could raise more troops than they could quickly arm, and there was a massive effort to build or buy as many guns as possible. Eventually, millions more muskets, rifles, carbines, and revolvers would be delivered to Union and Confederate soldiers. The Civil War would lead to dramatic advancements in the gun and the evolution of the firearm. Peace American Civil War is a hyper-realistic multiplayer mobile game where you can command the Union Army under Abraham Lincoln or join the Confederacy with Jefferson Davis. And this time, your gameplay will decide who wins the Civil War, North or South. Use your knowledge of American history to pick your choice of multiple commanders based on famous Civil War personalities, each having individual skills and bonuses. This game includes insanely detailed and authentic Civil War weapons and artillery, along with Civil War battle maps based on historical battles. With team play, you can join other War and Peace American Civil War players worldwide in an exciting balance of strategy and real-time virtual combat. You can also chat in real time and set up diplomatic ties with other alliances. Download the game using the link in the description for hours of exciting tactical Civil War gameplay. Start base building, develop war tactics, and take command by playing War and Peace, American Civil War.
In 1776, an arsenal was established in Springfield, Massachusetts. In 1794, it became the first national armory, and in 1795, it produced the first truly American musket. During the war, thousands of 1766 Charlevilles had been delivered to the colonies by their French allies, and the gun was well regarded by American soldiers. It served as the inspiration for the 1795 U.S. Army musket, which would be used during the War of 1812.
The model 1795 is considered the first American-made shoulder arm for the U.S. Army. This particular example is a copy of the 1795 made in Springfield, Massachusetts. But along with the arsenal in Massachusetts, there was an arsenal in Harpers Ferry, Virginia, that produced a copy of the 1795. This musket is almost an exact copy of the model 1777 Charleville musket given to us by the French government to support our revolution. It works like any flintlock. It uses a simple piece of flint in the lock mechanism that strikes against this steel face of frizzen or a hammer, as they called it during the 18th century. This is actually the cock, and this is the hammer. When you cock it, full cock, and press the trigger, a shower of sparks goes into the pan, igniting about a teaspoon's worth of gunpowder in the pan. That, in turn, goes into a tiny hole in the base of the barrel called a touch hole, igniting the main charge and firing the weapon. A good soldier was supposed to be able to fire three shots a minute. The model 1795 musket is the musket that we fought the War of 1812 with. This musket was replaced by a model of 1816, which had only a couple improvements, namely the pan. Rather than iron, it was made of brass and less susceptible to powder fouling and corrosion.
In 1799, construction began on the second National Armory at Harper's Ferry in the western part of Virginia that would eventually split off to become West Virginia. By 1810, over 10,000 muskets, rifles, and pistols were produced each year. A notable model musket produced at both the Harper's Ferry and Springfield Armories was the model 1816 flintlock musket. The model 1816 was an improvement on the model 1812, which had borrowed its design from the French Charleville of 1777. The 69 caliber barrel was 42 inches long, like the 1812, but the model 1816 had a longer lock plate, a shorter trigger guard, and a longer bayonet. In total, the musket was 58 inches long. Further improvements were made in 1822, 1835, 1840, and 1842. Almost 700,000 model 1816 muskets were manufactured at Harpers Ferry and Springfield between 1816 and 1844, more than any other U.S. flintlock musket. These were the muskets used to defend the Alamo in San Antonio, Texas, in 1836, and by the U.S. Army in the Mexican-American War. A major innovation occurred in 1839 that would solve one of the greatest problems plaguing flintlock guns, which was they didn't work well in wet weather. If the powder became wet while it was added to the priming pan, the primer charge wouldn't ignite, and therefore, neither would the gunpowder that would fire the bullet. Patented in 1822, the percussion cap was a small copper cap containing mercury or fulminate. The cap could be attached to a nipple and tube leading into the barrel of the gun. When the trigger was pulled, the gun's hammer would strike the cap, sending a flame through the nipple and tube into the barrel, igniting the gunpowder and firing the bullet. After the development of the percussion cap, many flintlock muskets were converted to the percussion system. This was a relatively simple conversion, as most hardware for the percussion system is exactly the same as the flintlock. The first standard U.S. rifle to use the percussion system was the M1841 Mississippi Rifle.
This is a model 1841 U.S. rifle, nicknamed the Mississippi, not because it was made in Mississippi, but because a regiment of Mississippi volunteers commanded by a man named Jefferson Davis, who was later to become the president of the Confederate States of America, commanded a regiment of Mississippi volunteers armed with the Model 1841 rifle in the Battle of Buena Vista during the Mexican-American War. The Battle of Buena Vista was fought in February of 1847, and the Mississippi volunteers were instrumental in winning that battle for the Americans. They checked an assault by Mexican forces. This weapon is 54 caliber, and it's extremely unique because it is the very first shoulder arm in the U.S. arsenal with a percussion system. The percussion system is really quite simple. It has a cone, or a nipple as it's called, and a small percussion cap would be fitted to that. The cap was full of a fulminating mixture called mercury fulminate. When you cock back the hammer to press the trigger, the hammer strikes the cap, sending a hot jet of flame through this bolster into a hole in the barrel, igniting the main charge. It's really loaded very much like any muzzle loader. The main cartridge would be pulled down the muzzle here and rammed home with the ramrod. Because this weapon has a great deal of brass furniture, it was considered a very attractive weapon for its time. It's got a brass muzzle strap up here, brass band, brass trigger guard, patch box, and butt plate.
The first regulation smoothbore musket with a percussion lock was the 1842 Springfield musket. Produced at both Springfield and Harper's Ferry, the 1842 model was a further development of the 1816 model. The original smoothbore 1842 model and a modified rifled version were used extensively in the Civil War. The next major development in firearms was not the gun, but the bullet. The Mini Ball was developed by French Army officer Claude Etienne Minier. The Mini Ball was a muzzle-loading, spin-stabilizing bullet for rifled barrels. With a cone-like shape similar to the modern idea of a bullet, it was made of soft lead and had a hollow base. Rather than the traditional bullet for a rifle, which had to fit tightly into the barrel, the Mini Ball was slightly smaller than the hollow of the rifle's barrel. When the gun was fired, the hollow base of the ball would expand, catching the grooves of the rifle barrel and taking full advantage of the increased speed and accuracy that the spin provided. Because the Mini Ball was slightly smaller, it was much easier to ram home than traditional bullets in a rifle. The loading drill taught not only the steps in loading the musket, but for the officers established a standard rate of fire for his men and his company. The drill would begin with the order. The musket brought to the center of the feet in a snug but convenient location to handle the rammer and to place eyes on the muzzle. And to his cartridge box, which held the 40 hand-rolled paper rounds, with a cartridge between the thumb and pointer finger. Place the cartridge to the mouth, using teeth to open the powder end of the cartridge, pull it to the front of the muzzle. Dumping the gunpowder down the barrel, then squeezing the bullet into the muzzle.
Draw, rammer!
Placing the tulip, or head of the rammer, upon the point of the bullet.
Ram cartridge. Turn lever.
In battle, many nervous soldiers would forget this and would shoot their rammers at the rebels.
Fire!
The musket is now eased in front of the soldier, muzzle down range at the height of the eye.
Shoulder! Fire!
In battle, every man was supposed to finish the loading process in 15 to 20 seconds. By the book, every man could shoot 3 rounds per minute.
Right.
A company of 90 muskets could fire 270 rounds per minute.
Right.
Every regiment of 10 companies could fire 2,700 rounds per minute. By the Middle War period, the average strength of a regiment in the Army of the Potomac was 400 men. Firing 3 rounds per minute, a veteran regiment could easily expend 12,000 rounds in a 10-minute firefight. The mini-ball would first be used extensively in Europe in the Crimean War. It would prove deadly there, and again in the American Civil War. While these developments were being made in muskets, rifles, and bullets, major innovations were taking place with handguns as well. And the greatest innovator of American handguns was Samuel Colt. As the slogan said, God created man, Sam Colt made them equal.
Colt's first patent was the 1836 Patterson revolver. It was an innovation in firearms design and technology. Now, that's not to say it was the first firearm that had a revolving cylinder on it or the idea of a revolving cylinder. There had been many before. The Collier and list of names that you don't recognize goes on and on, only to be found in the dusty records of the patent office. The reason why Colt is today a household word is because Colt's design was the first practical revolver. It was the first one that actually worked. Now, Colt produced a number of different models of this gun at Patterson, New Jersey, the plant that he worked from over at Patterson Falls. And his guns came in 3 different frame sizes, from 28 caliber up to 36 caliber. Most of them were 5-shot, not the common or more traditional 6-shot that we know of today. Colt took them down to Florida. There they were used during the Seminole War of 1838. A number of individuals that fought with the U.S. Army in Florida were exposed not only to Colonel Colt himself, but to his new firearm invention. Guys like Samuel Hamilton Walker of Maryland took Patterson revolvers with him when he left Florida and went west and became a Texas Ranger with Jack Coffey Hayes and the list of great Texas Rangers from the 1840s when Texas was a republic. But unfortunately, it never found favor with the U.S. military at the time, because ordnance officers were afraid that if a soldier had the ability to discharge his weapon rapidly, he would do so indiscriminately. And, of course, there's the cost involved. Generally, an individual can fire a muzzle-loading gun 3 times a minute. Each one of those shots costs the ordnance department so many pennies per shot. You're able to triple or quintuple that rate of fire, that drives the cost up as well. So the idea was, limit the number of rounds you have, you limit the expense, and the individual firing will be much more economical on many levels in the discharging of his firearm.
Not all rifles were made at the U.S. Armories, of course. One popular model was the Sharps rifles, produced by the Sharps Rifle Manufacturing Company. The Sharps rifles played a role in Bleeding Kansas, the violent struggle between pro- and anti-slavery forces that preceded the Civil War. breech-loading sharps were supplied to anti-slavery activists. They were called Beecher's Bibles because activist Henry Ward Beecher insisted that while...
You might just as well read the Bible to buffaloes as to those fellows. They have a supreme respect for the logic that is embodied in Sharp's rifle.
One of the most violent actors in Bleeding Kansas would soon make a strike against the 2nd National Armory at Harper's Ferry. John Brown had killed men with a broadsword in Kansas, but at Harper's Ferry, in October 1859, he would lead what he hoped would be the start of a massive slave rebellion, armed by the arsenal at Harper's Ferry. John Brown's friend, abolitionist Frederick Douglass, warned that Brown would find himself in a steel trap of death. Colonel Robert E. Lee led a force of Marines to stop insurrection. Douglass' prediction was correct. He later described Brown's assault on Harper's Ferry.
On the night of the 16th of October, 1859, there appeared a party of 19 men, 14 white and 5 black. They were not only armed themselves, but had brought with them a large supply of arms for such persons as might join them. 3 out of the 19 invaders were captured whilst fighting. And one of these was Captain John Brown.
John Brown died by hanging on December 2nd, 1859. Half his men were killed during the raid, including one of Brown's sons. Most of the others were captured and hanged. 4 men escaped, including another of Brown's sons. This was one more event to shock the consciences of the American people and to put them into opposing camps on the rightness of Brown's cause, if not his method. Less than 18 months after the raid on Harper's Ferry, the American Civil War began with the firing on Fort Sumter. This war would see the advancements in firearm technology take a shocking toll. As brother fought brother, the American gun would prove itself deadlier than ever. Although many soldiers were using older generation flint lock muskets converted to the percussion system, that didn't mean they liked it. Union Lieutenant John Meade Gould of the 1st Maine Regiment described their experience as their initial 90-day enlistments drew to an end soon after the first battle of Bull Run. On July 30th, the 6th Maine marched into our camp and changed muskets with us. They gave us the old flintlock smoothbore, altered over to a percussion lock, and understood to be more dangerous to the user and his right-hand comrade than to the enemy. We heard that all sorts of inducements were to be offered to us to reenlist, principally a new blue uniform and Springfield muskets, such as we had just lost. Those Springfield muskets were prized weapons among soldiers. The model 1842 Springfield musket was a 69 caliber smoothbore, originally manufactured with a percussion lock. It was the first U.S. Army musket to be manufactured at both the Springfield and Harper's Ferry armories.
So a model 1842 musket was developed 1 year after the model 1841 rifle. This was the standard shoulder arm for the U.S. infantry. Rifles at this time were considered a specialized weapon. This is, in fact, a smoothbore. Many of these weapons were later reboard for a conical ball. They were rifled and given a rear sight. This is a standard muzzle loader. Uses a ramrod to ram the main charge down the bore. It also is a percussion weapon, in that it uses a percussion cap to ignite the main charge. The Model 1842 was extremely robust and attractive weapon. and remained in U.S. arsenals right up to the Civil War. Many of these Model 1842 Springfields were issued to early volunteers, and some units had them in the U.S. Army right up through 1863. Warfare was still fought standing shoulder to shoulder in linear tactics, linear formations during the war with Mexico, and the rifle was really not suited for that purpose.
Although smoothbore muskets did not have the range or accuracy of rifles, they could be loaded and fired much more quickly than the muzzle-loading rifles available at the start of the war. To compensate for the poor accuracy of the smoothbores, soldiers frequently loaded the muskets with a combination of one heavy lead bullet and several pieces of buckshot. This buck-and-ball load was devastatingly effective at short ranges. Jacob Dolson Cox was a Republican senator of Ohio, later commissioned a brigadier general in the Ohio militia. After considering the many recent advancements in firearms, Cox later wrote, "The regular Army influence was generally against such innovations. Not once, but frequently, regular Army officers argued to me that the old smoothbore musket with buck-and-ball cartridge was the best weapon our troops could desire. We went through the war with a muzzle-loading musket." Brigadier General Thomas Mahar's Irish Brigade, consisting largely of Irish immigrants from New York regiments, was armed almost exclusively with the Model 1842 smoothbore. This continued even after they were phased out of most units in 1862. Mahar preferred the smoothbore over rifles, precisely because of the effectiveness of the buck-and-ball load. The Irish Brigade proved the value of smoothbores loaded with buck-and-ball at Gettysburg against Pickett's Charge. But of course, the rifle had substantial advantages over the smoothbore in terms of range and accuracy. Therefore, in 1855, the armory in Springfield, Massachusetts began planning a rifled musket that would have a unique design. The 58 caliber Model 1855 rifle was a departure from the 69 caliber muskets that the U.S. armories had been producing for decades. Testing by the Army had demonstrated that the smaller caliber rifles were more accurate with the new conical mini bullets. The Model 1855 was a muzzle-loading rifle, but had an unusual firing system. The new Maynard tape primer was used in place of the percussion caps, which were themselves a fairly recent improvement over the flintlock firing systems that had been used for centuries. A dentist by the name of Edward Maynard developed the tape primer as an inexpensive manner of containing the mercury of fulminate, which would ignite when struck, in turn igniting the gunpowder to fire the bullet. The tape primer looked and worked much like the strips of caps used for toy cap guns. As the gun was fired, the tape would advance, ready for the next shot. Unfortunately, it proved unreliable in practice. The tape was susceptible to moisture, and testing showed it failed to fire almost half the time. Nonetheless, the Model 1855 would become one of the most common shoulder arms of the Civil War. But that doesn't mean it was well loved. First Lieutenant John Meade Gould, whose regiment had been promised Springfield rifles if they re-enlisted, wrote about receiving Model 1855 Springfields. "The entire regiment had the Springfield rifled musket, caliber 58, with the Maynard primer attachment, a contrivance never used during the war to our knowledge, and I believe it was left off of all muskets manufactured after the first few thousand." Dr. Maynard founded the Maynard Arms Company, which contracted with the Massachusetts Arms Company to produce a breech-loading rifle of his design. Although not produced in close to the same numbers as the muzzle-loading Springfield rifles, they were well-regarded. The Confederate Field Manual listed the Maynard carbine as one of the official arms of the Confederate Army. Many Confederate soldiers carried these guns, calling them simply Maynard rifles. An ordnance officer, Captain L. Jacqueline Smith, reported to his colonel after inspecting some companies near Tallahassee, Florida, in February 1864. Captain Smith's report highlights the variety of arms that a single company might possess.
Company I, South Florida Cavalry, Captain Paramore, armed with Maynard rifles, 40, Mississippi rifles, 6, Enfield rifles, 5, Hall's carbines, 7, double-barreled shotguns, 5. This company has taken good care of their arms, though the horses were by no means as well kept. Captain Griffin's company, 59 men, no arms. Captain Gwynn's company, 73 men, arms just received, smoothbore muskets, caliber 69, in very poor condition. Most of the locks in very bad order. General appearance of the arms, very bad, and will doubtless soon become unserviceable. Captain Simmons, Company G, armed with Maynard rifles and sabers, arms in good condition, well taken care of, but have only 5 rounds of ammunition. None of the companies armed with Maynard rifles are able to procure a supply of ammunition, owing to its peculiar character.
The problems with the Maynard tape primer led to its elimination from the next model Springfield. The 1861 model Springfield rifled musket would become the most widely used long arm of the Union Army. It would be popular with the Confederates, too, when they could get their hands on one. The new model maintained the .58 caliber barrel, but replaced the tape primer with individual percussion caps loaded each time the gun was fired. This percussion system was a bit slower, but much more reliable. The 1861 model also added a rear sight to increase accuracy. The Union soldiers loved their Springfield rifles. The Confederate soldiers had to look elsewhere. The South lacked the industrial power of the North, and once the war began, the federal government stopped allowing Northern gun manufacturers to sell to the Southern states. At the beginning of the war, on April 18, 1861, the Union soldiers based at the Harper's Ferry Armory set it on fire in an effort to prevent it from falling into the hands of the Virginia militia marching toward them. Residents of the town of Harper's Ferry depended on that armory. So, put the fire out, saving most of the equipment. The Confederates took all of the equipment required for manufacturing muskets and sent it to Richmond. Early that summer, the Richmond Armory started producing rifles on the Springfield pattern. Though the armory in Richmond would eventually send hundreds of thousands of arms to the Confederate armies, these would primarily be firearms retrieved from battlefields and repaired. The Richmond Armory was never able to produce more than 1,500 rifles in a single month. The Confederacy would need to find arms elsewhere, and soon. The Union and Confederate governments would both need to purchase arms abroad, particularly in the early years of the war, but the rebels figured that out first. In April 1861, the Confederate government sent Captain, later Major, Caleb Hughes to Europe to procure the arms. Hughes worked tirelessly to find sources of arms and ammunition. The Confederacy had no access to international credit, but Hughes was able to purchase arms using King cotton. Literally millions of pounds of cotton were traded for weapons needed by the Confederacy. In his Rebel War Clerk's Diary, published after the war, Clerk J.B. Jones wrote regarding Hughes and other purchasing agents.
August 23rd, 1861. No arms yet of any amount from Europe. Though our agent writes that he has a number of manufactories at work. The U.S. agent has engaged the rest. All the world seems to be in the market buying arms. Mr. Dayton, U.S. minister in Paris, has bought 30,000 flintlocks in France, and our agent wants authority to buy some too. He says the French statisticians allege that no greater mortality in battle occurs from the use of the percussion and the rifled musket than from the old smoothbore flintlock. This may be owing to the fact that a shorter range is sought with the latter.
But the Confederate government wasn't looking for flintlocks. In directives to purchasing agents working with Hughes, the Secretary of the Confederate Navy wrote, "If you can purchase 10,000 good in-field rifles, muskets with bayonets, do so at once, without regard to price." Hughes negotiated contracts with the best rifle manufacturers in Great Britain for purchase of the Model 1853 British Enfield rifle. Also known as the P-53 Enfield, it would be the primary firearm of the Confederate Army. Almost a million of these rifles would make their way from Britain to America during the war, most bound for the Confederacy. The P-53 Enfield was a .58 caliber percussion ignition rifle. It fired the conical mini-ball bullets and was well regarded for its accuracy. That is, most Enfields were well regarded. Thanks to Hughes' efforts, the Confederacy was able to purchase almost all machine-made Enfields with interchangeable parts. In a May 21, 1861 letter to the Confederate Ordnance Bureau, Hughes wrote that after arriving in London,
"A very short time sufficed to satisfy that of small arms there were none in the market of the character and quality required. There were muskets to be purchased in any quantity, called by different names. I heard of not a few Enfield rifles. These, when I came to examine them, I found to be, for the most part, worthless. I then made inquiries at the London Armory Company for Enfield rifles to be manufactured by them. This establishment is, in some respects, superior to every other musket manufacturer in the world, and in every respect equal to the government works at Enfield. The rifles at this establishment interchange in every part with the perfect accuracy. The importance of the principle of interchange of parts I need not dwell upon. It is fully recognized by the war departments of every civilized nation. The London Armory Company is the only establishment in Europe, excepting the government armories, that works upon this principle. I propose to take from the company 10,000 Enfield rifles of the latest government pattern, with bayonet, scabbard, extra nipple, snap cap, and stopper."
The Confederacy became the London Armory Company's number one client. Over 70,000 rifles and 7,000 revolvers would eventually ship from the company to the Confederate buyers, though they had to pass the Union blockade ships to get there. As for those other Enfield pattern rifles that Hughes found, the ones he called, for the most part, worthless, they often ended up on ships bound for the Union. Union agents also purchased many Enfield rifles, but Hughes had locked in the contract with the London Armory. The Enfields the Union purchased were generally made by smaller outfits, which assembled the rifles using parts from various smaller manufacturers. The parts were not always uniform, which led to the Enfields getting a bad reputation with some Union units. John Need Gould of Maine wrote, "On October 21st, muskets were delivered to the men, and this furnished another excuse for a hearty growl from the first Mainers. Had we not been promised a new blue uniform and Springfield muskets? To be sure, we had the blue uniform, but look at these Enfield muskets with their blue barrels and wood that no man can name. They were not a bad weapon, however, differing little from the Springfield in actual efficiency, weight, length, and caliber, but far behind in point of workmanship. Gould's regiments were more fortunate than some. The Enfields provided to the 35th Massachusetts Infantry were actually defective. The nipples on the fire mechanism were brittle and shattered when hit by the gun's hammer. But the rifles were used throughout the Confederacy and proved themselves reliable weapons. The next most commonly imported firearm was the Austrian Lorenz. Originally a 54 caliber gun, it is often rebored to 58 caliber. Well regarded in Europe, the Lorenz was snapped up by Union and Confederate purchasing agents scouring Europe for arms. Over 225,000 were purchased by the Union and 100,000 by the Confederacy. Leander Stillwell, a soldier with the 61st Illinois Volunteer Infantry, wrote, "We were furnished with the Austrian rifle musket. It was of medium length, with a light brown walnut stock, and was a wicked shooter. At that time, the most of the Western troops were armed with foreign-made muskets imported from Europe. Many regiments had old Belgian muskets, a heavy, cumbersome piece, and awkward and unsatisfactory in every way. We were glad to get the Austrians, and were quite proud of them. We used these until June 1863, when we turned them in and drew in lieu thereof the Springfield rifle musket of the model 1863. It was not as heavy as the Austrian, was neater looking, and a very efficient firearm." Loading and cleaning firearms in the field could be a difficult and hazardous affair. The wide variety of weapons, calibers, firing mechanisms, and ammunition didn't make it any easier. John Meade Gould of Maine described how men in his regiment loaded their weapons.
"In our regiment, we had the combustible envelope cartridge manufactured by Johnson and Dow in New York, which is put in the musket entire without tearing the paper. Consequently, our fire was rapid compared with what was common with the muzzle loader. Some of the men say that they loaded by dropping the cartridge and bring the musket smartly to the ground, and the shock would send the cartridge home."
But the process varied across weapons and units. The buildup of black powder which fouled the rifles was a constant problem. One solution was the development of cleaner bullets. Developed by Elijah Williams, these had a thin zinc disc attached to the base of the bullet. When the gun fired, the zinc disc scraped along the bore. The first rounds were issued to Union troops in 1862. The model 1861 Springfield was updated in 1863. Minor improvements were made to this already reliable rifled musket, including new oval clamping bands, a new ramrod, and a case-hardened lock. John Meade Gould's regiment received the upgraded Springfields in January 1864.
"We had the 1863 pattern of the Springfield rifled musket, muzzle loading as almost all the arms of the infantry were, and differing from those we had before in a number of small points, having among other things heavier bands and no Maynard primer. It was the best musket we ever had."
So far, we have mostly looked at the long arms of the Union and Confederacy, but handguns were prized weapons as well. The most widely used revolver of the Civil War was the 44 caliber 1860 Colt Army model. Over 125,000 were purchased from Colt's manufacturing company by the Union and sent to troops in the field. In the months leading up to the war, some southern states stocked up on arms from Colt and other manufacturers, but the federal government put a halt to that after the outbreak of hostilities. A muzzle-loading, single-action, six-shot revolver, the Colt Army model was accurate up to about 100 yards. The 1861 Colt Navy model was similar to the 1860 Colt Army revolver, but with a slightly shorter barrel and less recoil.
The model 1851 Colt Navy revolver is termed Navy not because it was intended for issue to Navy personnel, but because it had a Navy motif engraved upon its cylinder. This particular pistol is 36 caliber, and it is a cap and ball revolver because it takes percussion caps to fire it. And you can load this pistol with loose powder and ball, but you can also use a pre-made paper or linen cartridge. To load this weapon, it's really quite simple. You put it on half cock. One click of the hammer will free up the cylinder to rotate freely. Underneath the barrel, on this hinged pivot, is a ramrod. You unclip it simply from its catch under the barrel, and that frees it up for movement. You move it upright, and you load the powder and the ball in each cylinder as you rotate it. You'll ram that down with the rammer, like so. Then you'll use this little cutout to put a percussion cap on each cone or nipple. Once all six of those are loaded, a process which can take about 10 minutes roughly, sometimes a lot less, then you're ready to fire. Well, this Colt Navy, along with the Colt Army revolver, were the most widely used revolvers during the Civil War.
Handguns were prized weapons, but hard to come by, except for cavalry and officers. John Meade Gould of Maine wrote of an experience demonstrating the value of a gun that could fire six times without reloading. The story of Walton was told by the citizens is brief. He was far behind the regiment when the rebel cavalry made a dash upon the stragglers. Walton fired and ran into the field, thinking perhaps that the fences would save him from pursuit. Some fine rider, the citizen said it was General Ashby himself, followed him and called surrender. Walton still retreated, loading. He was a stubborn, self-willed fellow. To surrender without a fight was no part of his nature. He said, only I won't surrender. Therefore, poor Walton was shot before he could reload his musket. With these two combatants, the question was not who fought the better. It was a contest of the revolver with the slow-loading muzzleloader, and the revolver won. As in Gould's story of poor Walton, most revolvers held by the Union or Confederacy ended up with the cavalry. The revolver was truly the ideal weapon for cavalry. They were also popular among the guerrilla fighters in the border states. The six guns were the perfect weapon for ambushes. When a small band of bushwhackers in Kentucky, Missouri, or Arkansas ambushed an unsuspecting unit, whether Confederate or Union, that unit's superior rifles were unlikely to have a chance against the hailstorm of bullets flying from the guerrilla's six guns. These guerrilla fighters would carry multiple six guns, so they would never find themselves unable to shoot back. When Federal soldiers killed some of Bloody Bill Anderson's Missouri Raiders, they collected 30 revolvers from the six corpses. There are rifles and there are rifles. Just as a marksman is capable of more than the average soldier, so is he likely to want a rifle that is more than the average Springfield. Lieutenant Colonel William Ripley of the 1st United States Sharpshooters later wrote about the formation and arming of his Vermont Rifleman unit.
Occasionally, a musket would be found that was accurate in its shooting qualities, and occasionally such a gun would fall into the hands of a man competent to appreciate and utilize its best features. It was speedily found that such a gun in the hands of such a man was capable of results not possible to be obtained from a less accurate weapon in the hands of a less skillful man. To remedy this state of affairs and to make certain that the best weapons procurable should be placed in the hands of the men best fitted to use them effectively, it was decided by the War Department early in the summer of 1861 that a regiment should be organized to be called the 1st Regiment of the United States Sharpshooters, and to consist of the best and most expert rifle shot in the northern states. The detail of the recruiting and organization of this regiment was entrusted to Hiram Berdan, then a resident of the city of New York. Himself an enthusiastic lover of rifle shooting and an expert marksman. A detail of the best men was made and a display of skills took place which perhaps was never before equaled. President Lincoln himself took part in the firing. Then president using a rifle belonging to Corporal H.J. Peck of the Vermont Company.
Briefly noted that originally the men were going to provide their own rifles, fine guns designed for precise shooting on the target grounds. But it was then decided that these guns were not suited to the rigors of combat. Despite opposition from the ordnance chief, Hiram Berdan's sharpshooters finally received their Sharps rifles while on a peninsular campaign in Virginia in May 1862. 2,052 caliber breech-loading model 1859 Sharps rifles were produced for Berdan's men, and they loved them. One of the features that made Christian Sharps rifles so attractive was the breech-loading design, which allowed for much faster reloading than a standard muzzle loader like the Springfield rifles. The Sharps used a falling block design to allow the breech load. The Sharps rifles were only sighted to 800 yards, but the sharpshooters didn't let this stop them. One reason that the ordnance officers were resistant to ordering Sharps rifles was that the production of the rifles would delay production of a much more popular weapon, the Sharps carbine. Christian Sharps patented his Sharps carbine in 1848. Over the course of the war, almost 100,000 Sharps guns were put into service in either Union or Confederate hands, and most of these were the shorter-barreled carbines. Like the Sharps rifles, the 52 caliber carbines were breech-loading for a quick reload. Both the Sharps rifles and carbines were highly regarded by the troops who used them. The carbines were particularly prized by the Union cavalry. The Confederate government recognized the quality of the model 1859 carbine and contracted with a Richmond firm to manufacture copies. The Sharps rifles were not the only makes prized by sharpshooters. Other rifles valued by marksmen but not always loved by the chief of ordnance were the Henry repeating rifle and the Spencer 56x56. The Henry rifle, designed by Benjamin Tyler Henry, was a breech loader like the Sharps and had the distinction of being the fastest shooting shoulder arm in the Civil War, with a magazine that could hold 15 metallic rimfire cartridges. Officers worried that such a rate of fire would mean a lot of wasted bullets. The Henrys were never provided in the same numbers as the Sharps, but they were often purchased by individual soldiers who hoped that being able to fire up to an incredible 30 rounds per minute would give him an edge. Indeed, Confederate soldiers were said to call the Henry that damned Yankee rifle that they load on Sunday and shoot all week. But rebel soldiers also managed to get their hands on Henry rifles. A large number of Henrys were captured or were privately purchased by Southerners. The Confederate government placed no orders for these repeating rifles, but the guns were available on the open market, and many were bought by or for Confederate soldiers. Though most of the Henrys used by the South had been captured from the North, in particular, the Virginia cavalry made good use, or bad, depending on your perspective, of Henry rifles captured from the 1st D.C. Cavalry, the only federal unit fully equipped with Henrys. The Henry rifle would have a second life after the war, evolving into the famous 1866 Winchester.
Guys like Christian Sharps were very innovative in their breech-loading rifle designs, but they were still hampered by the fact that they were using black powder cartridges. They weren't evolved into self-contained metallic cartridge yet. With the Spencer, you still had a paper cartridge, almost a flash paper top style casing for the bullet that held the powder. You put it in the breech, drew up the falling block on the spence on the sharps. You still had to put a percussion cap on the end of the gun. It was evolving from having to use a percussion cap like you did with a Burnside or Smith or Gwynn and Campbell that hampered the ability to be able to fire rapidly and repeatedly with carbines during the Civil War. It was the development of the 44 caliber rimfire cartridge that first appeared in the Henry rifle, and the 56 caliber cartridge that was in the Spencer carbine and rifle that really accelerated firearms development and use through the superior firepower during the Civil War period.
The Spencer rifles, designed by Christopher Spencer, were used more widely than the Henrys. Like the Henry, the Spencer 56x56 used a self-contained metallic rimfire cartridge. The Spencer's 7-round magazine was half of Henry's, and it took a bit more time to load. But it was a sturdier gun, more apt to survive the rigors of the trail and combat, and its cartridge packed a lot more punch than the 44 cartridge fired by the Henry. Like the Henry, the Spencer used a rolling block design to feed cartridges into the chamber with the pull of a lever. The Army preferred the Spencer in testing and initially ordered 10,000. Lieutenant Colonel Grover S. Warmer, commanding the 8th Michigan Cavalry, wrote to his headquarters in July 1863,
"Unarmed, the Spencer rifles proved, as before, a terror to the rebels. They fought us in much stronger force than we were, when each man can pour 7 shots into them so rapidly. This is the first instance in the war, I think, where the proportion of killed was greater than the wounded. As far as reports come in, it is at least 3 killed to 1 wounded, and this fact is owing to the terrible execution of our rifles."
However well a soldier's rifle fired, there was always the possibility that the gun could become even more valuable in a situation that didn't involve gunpowder at all. When the enemy is right on top of you, you don't always have time to load your weapon, especially if he is screaming down at you as part of a bayonet charge. Bayonets didn't see as much use in the Civil War as they had in previous wars, in large part due to improvements in firearms that allowed for greater range and greater rate of fire. Gone were the days of standing 2 armies 50 yards apart, firing a few volleys with smoothbores to soften them up for deadly hand-to-hand combat with bayonets. But the bayonets were still used. They made excellent candle holders, with the point stabbed into the ground and the candle held in the top. And they could also be used as a spade in a pinch to dig trench works or latrines. But their military use had not disappeared. The bayonet's most famous use in the Civil War was in defense of Little Round Top at Gettysburg. The 20th Maine was assigned to hold Little Round Top under the command of Brigadier General Joshua Chamberlain. From the 15th Alabama was critically low on ammunition. Chamberlain ordered a bayonet charge, which routed and captured the rebels, earning for himself the Medal of Honor.
Well, I think you've had an opportunity to hear quite a bit about the firearms and the going all the way back to George Washington and all the way up to the Civil War, almost to the conclusion of the Civil War, how much this particular weapon has changed, and it's completely changed today. And it is a very destructive kind of weapon in terms of someone being shot by a pistol 7 times in the back. And what that weapon is actually capable of doing at close range or at a distance. I wanted you to hear something about that, this particular weapon, because there's so many people today who are having a problem with it being used improperly. Not defense, but it's just using wrong in a wrong manner. I'll talk to you more about this on Friday when I go into some great details about weaponry and other things that are used today that are harmful in the taking of a life. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Walter Dean. Have a good evening, people.